Well, welcome to After Hours, which is actually after half hour. This is a super abbreviated show, but for the entire half hour, minus even commercials, I'm going to talk with my old pal, David Murray, about a book that I found incredibly provocative and even hopeful. Its title is An Effort to Understand, Hearing One Another and Ourselves in a Nation Cracked in Half. David, how are you?
I'm great, Rick. How are you?
It has been a very long time. We used to see each other and have drinks occasionally. When you first moved to Chicago, David, remind me why you first moved. You came here to make your way as a writer in this writer's town, did you not?
I did. I grew up in Ohio. I was the son of two writers. And I kind of realized when I graduated from Kent State University that I had to get to a bigger place than Cleveland or than Ohio to sort of make a writing career. New York was a little too scary,
so I
settled on Chicago. It still is.
You did some fine work for me when I was editor of the Tempo section, but it is a tough life to crack into this town as a freelance writer. Didn't you find?
Well, I did find that. Yeah. I was the nobody sent. that's not a good person to be. But you know, a number of people, including you, were very, very helpful. I think that there was a sense that if you pounded your head against the wall enough times, and if you really wanted it, Chicago could sense that.
Yeah.
And people like you could sense this kid's pretty hungry. Let's give this kid one try. And I got that, and I'm forever grateful for that.
Well, and you've been very successful, I think. Don't misconstrue me. I don't know what the Professional Speechwriters Association is, of which you were the head. So tell me what it is.
Yeah. So one of the first jobs I had when I came to Chicago was a job working at a little trade newsletter company that published a newsletter called Speechwriters Newsletter.
Huh.
And for God's sakes, it was a weekly print newsletter that went out to about 500 people in the world who called themselves professional speechwriters. So these would have been speechwriters to President Reagan. Hmm. This would have been speechwriters to CEOs. And I did a little apprenticeship on that newsletter. And over the years, in and out of my journalism career in Chicago, in and out of a lot of other things, I never really lost touch with those speechwriters. And I became the editor of a magazine called Vital Speeches of the Day, which goes back to 1934, also sort of along the way. And at some point in the middle of this, some speechwriters came to me and said, "We need an association. We need, we're like the lighthouse operators. We can't even communicate with each other, and there's about five of us."
Yeah.
And so now I run this, you know, global speechwriters association, where speechwriters come from all over the world to our conference in Washington every year. It's nutty, it's strange, it's interesting, but it surrounds me with really fascinating people who have led unpredictable lives. They didn't want to be a speechwriter when they grew up, you know?
Who does?
Right.
I mean, that's not an aspiration that even most writers have, but I think it still is an unbelievably challenging way to write a speech, to put words into the mouth of someone who is going to try to communicate. This book, An Effort to Understand, Hearing One Another and Ourselves in a Nation Cracked in Half. I will not dispute that this is a nation cracked in half. What was the compelling reason to sit down? I mean, I know you do a blog called mm-hmm. Writing Boots, mm-hmm. but what was the compelling reason? I mean, obviously, over the last, you know, 8, 10, 12 years, you have seen a lack of communication between people in this country. Was that one of the reasons, David?
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing that blog and these essays since Obama got elected.
Yeah.
Since before Obama got elected. And we really think of this last election and of 2016 as these unbelievably divisive elections. But my God, you know, Obama was being accused of being a terrorist and being, you
sure.
know, not from this country. Like, it was dangerous back then. And so I started writing these essays about that and exploring this idea. I come from writers.
Yeah.
I've been surrounded
yeah.
my whole life by writers. And when we all sit around the drinking table, writers, at some point, somebody just, it just, there's this sense that, God, if only if only everybody knew what we know, we communicators, we oral historians, we writers, we public relations people, we speechwriters, if they only knew what we knew, the world would be just a more civilized, less rancorous place. I wanted to put that to the test. Do we really know something that everybody else doesn't know?
Yeah.
And what is it that we think we know that can cure the world?
I think you do. And one of the aspects of the book that really surprised me, there's a great deal of hope in this book. And the book begins and ends. Don't get the wrong idea here, because I think the book is not some political screed at all. It begins and ends with what I consider among the greatest speeches ever given. It was off-the-cuff speech given by Robert Kennedy the night that Martin Luther King was killed, and he was standing in front of an all-black audience in Indianapolis. And you write in the book, David, early on in the book, David Murray, you write that you say that this book is not a call for civility. I believe that even the most politically opposed or culturally estranged or emotionally isolated Americans share vastly more common experience and values than we know, a reality we would become more consciously aware of if we redirected some of the intellectual energy we use to draw distinctions and describe our differences, and instead we applied that energy to see one another more clearly. And you do it, you go on to the book that is a series of very short, easily digestible, and beautifully written short chapters. You say you developed these ideas over three decades in and around journalism, oral history, public relations, leadership, and psychology. This is an unbelievably, and I commend you, this is an unbelievably thoughtful book. I'm going to start, and it's surprising, too. You know, one of the early chapters, chapter titled, and most chapters are only a couple pages long, easily digestible, as I say. One chapter is titled, Ask for What You Want, and you cite, and you actually, I've never seen this phrase used before, and I want you to sort of tell the listeners what it is, the Ron Santo rule of communication.
Yeah. Well,
what is that?
The worst people who we deal with on a day-to-day basis are the people who don't know what they want out of their day, out of their life, out of their Saturday afternoon. They either don't know what they want, or they won't tell you what they want, but you're supposed to guess what they want. And the best people to deal with, they're the worst people in the world. And the best people in the world are people who know exactly what they want, and they will tell you what they want. They'll acknowledge that there are other people with other interests, but you know what that person wants. And Ron, that was, to me, that was the entire charm of Ron Santo. Readers will recall this guy, you know, ask Ron Santo, would you like to be in the Hall of Fame? A lot of people say, oh, I don't
know. Well,
really,
you know, there are other deserving people and blah, 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 blah.
Yes, I want to be in the Hall of Fame, usually in tears. And I just thought, you know, his complete heart on the sleeve desire, I think that's what charmed Chicagoans. I mean, I think his gifts as a baseball analyst were rather limited.
Suspect.
I think so. His passion wasn't, though, and the Ron Santo rule, if you want something, ask for what you want. It's like the first rule. The first rule of baking is, you know, if you're going to make an apple pie, get a stove. Mm-hmm. And the first rule of communication is communicate what you want.
Yeah. You then cite, and it's divided into sections, too. Section two is Talking Heads. An empty limousine pulled up, and America's leaders got out and read prepared remarks. You take to task in that chapter, in that section, a former mayor of Chicago, and I think rightly so, David Murray, in his fabulous book, An Effort to Understand, now available online. It formally publishes this week on March 2nd, but you can get it anywhere. An Effort to Understand, Hearing One Another and Ourselves in a Nation Cracked in Half. I think in many ways it's kind of a read in total in one sitting or two. It will change the way you think. And that's something. Here you write, and I want to express my admiration for this. You're talking about Rahm Emanuel giving a speech in the wake of the Laquan McDonald shooting murder. Emanuel pretended he felt responsible, but the family didn't buy it. He screeched and shouted, and imitated mammal friends whose voices he had heard crack when they were in distress. But the speech was forgettable and thus regrettable. The speech was forgettable and thus regrettable because it offered nothing new. You have him pegged so precisely. He doesn't give speeches on, the George Stephanopoulos Morning Sunday show, but it certainly sounds like he has memorized what he's saying. He is terribly ineffective, wouldn't you say, David?
Yeah, there's just a quality of emotional remove with this guy that wasn't the case with his predecessor.
People think whatever they wanted of Richard J. Daley, but you would often hear, Daley's kind of a goof, but I like the guy.
And anybody who met him, I have this singular memory of seeing him at the first time I saw him in person, he was dedicating like a little league baseball field,
mm-hmm.
and he was out there and he had this diffident little sort of a shy way. He almost looked shy, but he also looked like he was enjoying it. Like he enjoyed being mayor of Chicago. And that's another thing that I talk about these politicians, you begged us for the job, Rahm Emanuel.
Yes.
And Barack Obama. You begged us and begged us and begged us for this job, and now you have it, and half the time it looks like we're just a giant pain in your ass.
Yeah. You write in the book, too, in this chapter, and we wanted to say to Rahm and to President Obama, on whose nerves we also seem to be occasionally dancing, we know the job is frustrating, but you begged and begged and begged and begged and begged us for it. So we gave it to you, and now you own it. Can't you manage to appear grateful and happy and game at least some of the time? That is such a precise and astute observation. You're happy with this book, are you not, David Murray?
I'm very proud of this book. This book is everything I... It's everything I think and know about communication, and I am truly happy.
Was it difficult to get published? I'm looking to see who the publisher is.
Publisher is a group called Disruption Books.
Yeah, out of Austin and New York. Okay.
Yes, they're a wonderful, wonderful publisher. I can't even explain to you honestly how wonderful they are. Every writer I've known, and I've known a thousand,
sure.
complains about their publisher.
Yes.
The publisher doesn't do enough. Doesn't care about their content. These guys, it was like dealing with Scribner in the 40s with these guys.
Right.
They were the unbelievable. I mean, the introduction of the book, which I think is one of the strongest pieces, was absolutely, I was coached through that by a fine editor, Chris Pauls, who's the publisher at Disruption. And they've just been a wonderful publisher all the way through, and it's made the book better than I ever thought it could be.
Well, it is a good book. You take on, too, another lovely chapter in this. And ladies and gentlemen, when you read the book, there's nothing wrong with, to my mind, you don't have to read it straight through like a Dostoevsky novel or something. But you can flip open to almost any page and find something as precise and intriguing as tech, as in wreck. You write here that voicemail, and you were so right about that. What I kept saying is, God, David Murray was a smart kid. He's gotten even smarter in the time we've spent apart.
Well, it's been about 20 years.
I know. Your daughter, how old's your daughter? 17?
She's 17, yeah, you got it.
18. She makes, your daughter makes some charming, Scout is her name, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Scout, everybody should know where that comes from. She makes some charming appearances in the book. But here you write, voicemail should go the way of the facts. Voicemail fills me with crawling dread because we all know it is by voicemail that catastrophe will come. What is your thought? What are your thoughts? I know they're in the book. Summarize that chapter for me, David. Tech is in wreck. You're no fan of email either.
I mean, I'm not a fan of that stuff as a complete substitute. I mean, we're really thinking about this as a society right now because companies are deciding whether to send people back to work together or not.
Yeah.
And I am, I think they're making the opposite. They're thinking the opposite of how they should be thinking. They're thinking, "Hey, it's been a year, and these relationships are pretty well holding steady, and our company's been working fine remotely for a year. It's been working remotely because those it's based on those relationships that were all built in the office for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 years.
Yeah.
The idea that you're going to run an organization in a long-term way, a cohesive, coherent organization, without having a lot of people with a lot of real personal human relationships, is absurd. And so you've got to, you know, we've been able to run these organizations for a year that way, but I think we've got to get people back together. And if you're going to bring new people in, how would you mentor new people over Zoom?
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. I think there are some, you know, Zoom may be the future of some sort of, you know, live streaming entertainment. But for that kind of thing, it leaves me very, very, very flat. And any book that features, you know, little things about Studs Terkel and a fascinating little bit about one of my heroes, Norman McLean, the University of Chicago professor who wrote A River Runs Through It. That's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful chapter. You also take some road trips in this book, don't you, David?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the significant – one of the reasons I think I can talk about Trump voters just barely begin to talk about that, is that I ride a motorcycle, and I take a motorcycle on back roads all across the Midwest all the time, and all across Illinois. And there are vignettes in the book where I'm riding a motorcycle, and I find myself in a cafe and in a small town in Greasy Spoon, in a small town in Illinois, and I'm talking to Trump people. I take Scout. I take my daughter in those, not on the motorcycle, but in the car on those roads as well. We do live in this huge bubble of Chicago, and it's really something to raise kids in this environment. I mean, Scout and her friends, when they hear that somebody they know voted for Donald Trump,
right?
They think that you're talking about a Martian. It's
I know.
Really exotic.
Yeah, it's so myopic. It's so myopic. And dangerous, I think. Don't you think it's dangerous, David?
I think it's so dangerous, and I actually have been thinking a lot about Stud. People are always talking about, I wish Studs was here, and I think people wish that Studs would be here to rail against the idiocy of Donald Trump.
But
I wish Studs were here because Studs invented the idea that every person had a story, every person had dignity, every person, I mean, when Studs sat down to interview a pipe fitter or a lawyer or an advertising person or anybody, the assumption was there's something I can learn from this person, there's something good in this person, basically there's something, I'm going to find a core wisdom from this person. And I think that when we're talking about Trump voters and when we're looking across the country and people like us are dismissing whole swaths of the population.
Well, it's also
calling them idiots.
It's a loss of respect for what used to be called the common men. It's a loss of respect because, you know, I'm sure you rail against the nonsense on Fox and the nonsense on CNN, and that's been, television seems to be the sort of divisive wedge that is getting larger and larger between people. And those chapters where you did talk to regular folk, as they say, and not the people, you know, sitting at the at Gibson's, for instance, you know, that.
I mean, the people that you're dismissing when you say that you know, that everybody who voted for Donald Trump is depraved or an idiot.
Yep.
Are people who have raised kids. We know how hard that is. There are people who have kept it together, kept a job together, kept a mortgage together, kept a marriage together, kept families together, kept communities together. These people, we may disagree with them deeply, but they are. But to dismiss them it's half the reason they're so mad in the first place.
Yeah, that's why I think your book is I think not reading between the lines. It's really one that is filled with hope. It certainly made me hopeful about a future in which we meaning the collective we that is in this country, can talk to one another without screaming or without telling each other to shut up or telling each other we're wrong. David, I really commend you for this book. I'm going to try to write about it, too, which is another way to communicate. And I hope, you know, in these button-down times, maybe you're doing a bunch of Zoom gatherings, are you, to promote the book? I mean, in the old days, you'd be at a dozen bookstores.
Yeah, it's Zoom. Bookstores do Zoom talks. I'm doing one on Tuesday night at the Bookseller with Tony Judge, our mutual friend.
Fantastic.
He and I are going to have a conversation. And, yeah, there are a number of those, and there are a number of other appearances. But, yeah, I do want to talk about this. You know, a writer was telling me that he hates book tours because he's always on to the next thing, and so he's got to talk about this book that was, like, basically written 2 years ago,
yeah.
And now he's thinking about, you know, something else. That's not at all true about this book.
No,
for me.
David, like, Murray, your book, and it's an effort to understand, is so of the moment. Let's resurrect our friendship and have a drink one of these days.
I would love that.
Yeah, so would I, David. So would I. Take good care.
Rick, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate
my,
it. Great.
My pleasure.
To you,
my pleasure. Now that's the end of the Rick Kogan half an after-hours show. See you next Sunday.